From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. In today's show, we talk to a reporter from North Carolina Health News about what the U.S. Supreme Court case on the abortion medication mifepristone means for North Carolina. And it's Solar Eclipse Day. A Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center education specialist, she educates me on what's up in the sky today. And first, with two North Carolina State teams playing in the Final Four college basketball championships, Wolfpack fans had a busy weekend of watching, cheering, but not celebrating. The men went up against Purdue, and the women tried their best against South Carolina.
NC State at 20-12 advantage all time. And how about Sanaya Rivers jumping against Camila Cardoso?
Her fingertips were right there.
South Carolina leads by one here at halftime, 32-31.
Undefeated South Carolina will play for the national championship.
This is a battle of big men. This is a fight night in Glendale, a heavyweight matchup. You've got Zach Edey, 7'4", 300 pounds. You got DJ Burns, 6'9", 275.
Nine lives was all NC State had during this winning streak. They couldn't get the 10th. Purdue wins it, wire to wire.
Well, North Carolina State sadly did not make it to the finals in either tournament. Joining me to talk about the Final Four games and the legacies of these teams and this season are WNCN-CBS 17 sports director Chris Clark in Phoenix, where he covered the Final Four games on Saturday and will be reporting on the men's, you know, championship game, I guess, from now until eternity, and WUNC's own digital news producer, Mitch Northam, and a voter in the top 25 poll for women's college basketball. He's in Cleveland after spending the weekend covering the women's NCAA basketball championship. Well, Chris and Mitch, welcome to Due South.
Oh, thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it.
Hello, Leonita. Thanks for having me.
Oh, hi there, Mitch. We're going to start with you. State's women have had an extraordinary season, but Dawn Staley's South Carolina team was just too much for the Pack. Really, you know, they've been too much for everybody, right? That's why they are once again national champions. Right, Mitch?
Yeah. I think this is one of Dawn Staley's best coaching jobs ever, maybe. You know, a year ago, they lost in the Final Four to Iowa. And that team, you know, she lost all five starters plus a sixth player off the bench who was drafted into the WNBA as well. And she just restocked and reloaded, and they went 38-0 and beat NC State and beat Iowa, both pretty comfortably, and won the national title. It's her third national title, and she's one of five coaches now with that many joining. You know, the names on this list are Pat Summitt, Gino Auriemma, Tara Vanderveer, and Kim Mulkey, and now Dawn Staley. And Dawn Staley is the only Black woman in that group, which I think is pretty significant considering this is a sport primarily played by minority women. And yeah, against NC State, you know, South Carolina was just bigger and they were deeper. You know, they played nine players. I think that depth allows them to play more aggressively, and they dominated on the board. So, you know, a really great run for NC State, but they just weren't a match for South Carolina, particularly in the second half. You know,
I know it was kind of hard to watch that, them run out of steam a little bit. But I like to think, you know, we know State's women actually beat South Carolina a few years ago. A lot of people don't get to do that.
Yeah, they were the last team to beat South Carolina in Columbia, December 2020. And since then, yeah, the Gamecocks haven't lost in that building down there in Columbia, South Carolina. But yeah, you know, it was a great run for NC State. This was a team that was picked to finish eighth in the ACC this year in the preseason. They were unranked in the AP poll to start the year. You know, second game of the season, they shock everyone and they beat UConn handily in Reynolds Coliseum. They get in the AP poll that way. They beat Colorado. They beat some other really good
teams.
That's
what everybody start noticing them this season. It's like, wait a minute. Look at these women.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, really got on a roll and, you know, played in the ACC tournament final, came up a little short against Notre Dame. But then in the NCAA tournament, you know, beat Tennessee, Stanford, and Texas to make their first Final Four since 1998. So significant year for Westmore and the NC State women. And the good news for them is, you know, a lot of these players on this team are coming back next year, except for River Baldwin and Mimi Collins, who are out of eligibility.
Wow. Maybe they'll be party crashers again next year. We're hoping for that. You know, even though it wasn't, you know, NC State in the finals, I want to touch briefly on something that I read in a piece in The Athletics, what Jim Trotter wrote. He says, just when you thought this women's basketball season couldn't give anymore, just when you thought it had drained itself of record on-court performances, all-time viewership numbers, and compelling grudge matches, it is giving us an opportunity to witness all three in one game. And that was in the Iowa against South Carolina in the national championship showdown that most fans, and they say, of course, all ABC executives want it, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think when the brackets were drawn up, you know, the TV folks were particularly excited for the Elite Eight matchup between Iowa and LSU, which drew 12.3 million viewers. And then they got Iowa versus UConn in the Final Four. That drew 14.2 million viewers. Both of those marks were more than last year's national championship game, which set a record. And we don't have the figures yet for yesterday's game, but I would be willing to bet quite a lot of money. You know, I'll use that term since sports betting's legal now in North Carolina, that it shattered a record as well. I imagine yesterday was probably the most watched women's basketball game on record.
Well, I was one of those watchers. Chris Clark of CBS 17, you're in Arizona. Are you going to be there tonight for the men's championship? Are you heading back to Raleigh?
I wish. We're flying out of here. So we're actually going to be in the air while the game is going on. So I'm going to get all my parlay bets in before we take off and then hope when I land, be okay.
Wow. We really wanted the Wolfpack men to make it to the finals. But Indiana, oh, my goodness. I mean, not India. I mean, come on, Indiana, Purdue. They're in Indiana too, right? Yes. What a matchup. You know, we saw our big boys do their best, right?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, nobody gave this team any kind of chance. They were talking about Kevin Keats looking for another job going into the ACC tournament. So, I mean, you know, now I'm going to start the Kevin Keats rumor of going to Kentucky. No, just playing. Don't do that. Just kidding. No, they were looking at, you know, trying to find somebody new to coach the team up. And then, you know, they, you know, to quote Forrest Gump, you know, they beat Louisville and they just kept on going. I mean, you know, so they kept winning and found themselves in Phoenix. And everybody kept calling them Cinderella. And I don't know if I might have said this last time, but the best quote I heard was when they asked Muhammad Diarra if he felt like Cinderella, and he smiled and looked around and he goes, yeah, that's not an insult because I have no idea who that is, what that means. So they literally just kept playing their best basketball each and every time out, nine games in a row, and strung it together at the right time. And, you know, they had one off night, and it just so happened to be in the Final Four against a very determined and really talented Purdue team.
Wow. Amazing. You know, all the young players, they're back home in Raleigh now, I guess, trying to finish up the semester. But I know this was a very historic run. I hope they understand that significance. I saw a lot of smiles when they got off the buses, actually.
Well, I think it kind of set in exactly what they had done. I mean, you know, the last team to make it that far was, you know, Wittenberg and that crew there, and who were all out here, by the way, I mean, enjoying and celebrating. And, you know, and I think it really kind of sunk in exactly how special it was what they did. I mean, no NC State team had been to the Final Four since 83, and that was Jim Valvano's squad. Mm-hmm. And that's legend, not just in Raleigh at NC State, but you say Jimmy V, I mean, it's all over. So I think it's starting to kind of sink in that, you know, they did go on an incredible run to win the ACC tournament, which, you know, they hadn't done that in a while either. So, I mean, let's check that box off. But to make it to a Final Four, I mean, just to make it, you're one of four teams left out of everybody that started and everybody that begins, you know, practicing and putting up shots in June, really, to get ready. I mean, that's where you want to get to. And then you got a fighting chance. And I think it kind of sunk in for him, and really just how special it was. And Casey Morcell said it best.
A lot.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. And he said that, you know, the best part, and it was funny to see the last thing he said to me when I was in the locker room with him. He goes, the best part about it was proving everybody wrong. And they did that 9 straight times. It wasn't just people in the ACC kind of writing them off. And it was nationally, and then, you know, regionally, rather, when they went to the first round, then nationally. And, you know, Coach Keith said, hey, you know, everybody's trying to bury us, but we're seeds and we're right where we need to be. And you know what happens when you bury a seed? We grow and blossom. It and they grew and blossomed into a Final Four team.
That's so great. Mitch, any last words before we go? Any surprises when you you saw the women play? Like you said, many of them will be back next year.
You know, not a ton of surprises. You know, I think about in 2022 when they were a number one seed and they had to go to UConn and play in Bridgeport, Connecticut, basically in UConn's backyard in the Elite Eight, and they lose in double overtime. This year when the bracket came out, I thought that they had a pretty good draw and they had a chance to make it to the Final Four. And they did that, you know, beating really good teams along the way. And yeah, I think this NC State team is going to be in the mix to win the ACC next season and make another run. And, you know, the men's team as well. Like, it was a whole lot of fun watching DJ Burns and that crew kind of bulldoze their way to the Final Four.
I know. Well, you know what? Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me this morning. And, I hope to chat with you again this time next year, right?
Certainly.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Chris Clark is sports director at WNCN CBS 17, and Mitch Northam is the digital news producer at WUNC, and he takes some really great sports photographs, you know. I'm Leonita Inge. This is Due South. I'm Leonita Inge, and this is Due South on WUNC. It seems that every week there's a new decision by a court that will impact abortion access in the U.S. Last week, a Florida Supreme Court ruling effectively banned abortions in that state after 6 weeks. The court also ruled in a separate decision that a proposed state constitutional amendment to guarantee certain abortion rights could go on the November ballot. And the week before that, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case involving the abortion medication mifepristone. A decision from the court could result in restricting access to the drug. North Carolina Health News reporter Rachel Crumpler recently told Due South that almost 70% of abortions in North Carolina in 2022 were medication abortions. Rachel rejoins us to talk about the case and how the decision could impact North Carolinians and how mifepristone is used and not used in North Carolina now. Rachel, welcome to Due South.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You know, let's first talk about the Supreme Court case and the oral arguments that were heard recently. First, what can you tell us about mifepristone's history in the U.S.? Like, how long has it been around and approved by the Food and Drug Administration?
So the FDA first approved mifepristone in 2000, you know, after an extensive review process. And at that point, mifepristone was already approved in other countries. So in approving the medication, the FDA set some rules on how the medication could be dispensed. So, you know, over the past 20 years, the FDA, you know, has studied and reaffirmed mifepristone's safety and subsequently eased restrictions on how the medication can be dispensed. So I'll take you through some of those changes if you'd like.
Well, it's just amazing to even, well, I like you to do that, but going through the numbers that millions, about 6 million patients have actually taken this medication.
Yeah, that's true. Mifepristone is used, you know, for medication abortions, which account for about 2/3 of abortions nationwide. So it's very common to use mifepristone.
Well, what specifically is the case the Supreme Court will be ruling on?
So the case is Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA. So this was heard on March 26th before the Supreme Court. And the case got to the Supreme Court after some conflicting lower court rulings that had the potential to restrict access to mifepristone. So the Supreme Court, you know, enjoined those decisions until the justices had an opportunity to take up the case and issue their own ruling. So kind of the main question in this case is, like, plaintiffs are arguing that the FDA improperly, like, eased access to the medication. So kind of in question is, like, in 2016, the FDA expanded use of the medication from 7 weeks after a person's last menstrual period to 10 weeks. The FDA also allowed certain health care practitioners, such as nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to dispense the medication. So before, you know, only physicians were allowed to give the abortion pill, but they eased it to other, you know, certified healthcare practitioners. So that was the 2016 changes that are kind of up in this case. And then also in 2021, the FDA again loosened restrictions on the medication by eliminating an in-person requirement and allowing the pill to be sent through the mail. So that was a really big fundamental change that really improved access to abortion via telehealth.
Well, Rachel, in just very basic terms, you know, what is the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine? You know, and I guess all that they really want to do now.
So this is a handful of doctors that are against providing, you know, abortions. So they brought up this case thinking that, you know, mifepristone and how the FDA eased these restrictions kind of calls into question patient safety. But like I said, the FDA has studied this medication, you know, thoroughly. A lot of researchers and health policy people have really investigated mifepristone and its safety, and that's been reaffirmed over the years.
Is there any evidence that mifepristone is not safe?
Not really. Again, most studies have really shown that it is very safe and effective with minimal, you know, side effects or consequences for health. There were two studies that were cited by a Texas judge in his ruling suspending federal approval for the abortion pill. But those studies were actually retracted by the publisher because it came out, you know, that the science wasn't very thorough and there were very several flaws with how the research was conducted, and that the researchers hadn't disclosed, you know, their affiliation and kind of tied to anti-abortion kind of advocacy.
You know, to backtrack a little, you mentioned telehealth. So I wonder where and how has telehealth, has that option opened up abortion access since 2021? Has that been a good option for patients?
Yeah, telehealth has been really key for a large segment of the population. People have really used this method, and it's accounted for, you know, an increasingly large portion of how abortions are being obtained nationwide. I think the last data I saw was that now telehealth accounts for about 16% of abortions nationwide. But like I said before, not all states have this option of telehealth. But for the ones that do, it's really great because you can, you know, log on to your computer, do a telehealth appointment, go over the necessary medical information, and then have pills, you know, shipped to your house where you can, you know, do the abortion within your own home. And it can eliminate some really substantial, you know, practical barriers when you have to get care in person. You know, you have to travel, the cost of gas, the cost of hotels, childcare, all those can add up, but telehealth can eliminate some of those barriers if people can, you know, stay in their home, their own communities, and just access the healthcare with the provider online.
I know some of those who, some providers, I guess even Planned Parenthood, it's, I think there was mentions of, you know, for really people who may not have the money, they may need childcare, you know, they, you know, they don't have to pay for gas. You know, they don't have to take time off from work. But that's really being challenged, isn't it?
Yeah. If if the Supreme Court were to side with, you know, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, you know, telehealth wouldn't be an option anymore. They would basically roll back the restrictions and guidance on how the mifepristone can be dispensed back to the 2016 times, which are when there were still requirements that it be dispensed in person through a provider. So telehealth would not be an option. But the good news, seemingly so, based on the oral arguments, was that the justices seemed likely to preserve access to mifepristone.
Hmm. And after the 2022 Dobbs decision that dismantled Roe v. Wade and the federal right to an abortion, I wonder how significant has the expansion of mifepristone been? Like, did we see a jump, an increase?
Yeah, so the latest data released, you know, a couple weeks ago now from Guttmacher Institute, which, you know, tracks kind of rates of abortion. They've been doing really thorough studies on, you know, how people are accessing abortions. They found that, yeah, medication abortion is on the rise. People are, you know, accessing it more often. So now nationwide in 2023, 63% of abortions in the formal healthcare system were via medication abortion. And likely, you know, there's even more of people, you know, self-managing their abortions, you know, at home by ordering, you know, from online sites and accessing medication abortion that way. So it's medication abortion is really key with how people are accessing abortion, particularly in this post-Dobbs landscape.
Well, I'm speaking with Rachel Crumpler, a reporter for North Carolina Health News, covering reproductive health. And we're talking about the recent Supreme Court oral arguments in the case that could restrict access to the abortion medicine mifepristone. Well, now I guess I'd like to talk about North Carolina, you know, and North Carolinians, mail access and the telehealth option. And how much has it been an option for I guess, people in this state?
Yeah, so North Carolina, you know, I just described quite a bit of the loosening of restrictions and new ways that people can access medication abortion. But all of that hasn't happened in North Carolina. North Carolina hasn't felt this loosening of restrictions on how mifepristone can be accessed. That's because our state law goes further than what the FDA requires. So to access medication abortion in North Carolina, you know, someone has to go in person to a clinic. The abortion pill has to be handed to you by a physician, and there has to be a 72-hour waiting period and an ultrasound. So there's quite a few of additional requirements that people have to go through to get a medication abortion. And, you know, in contrast, I talked to a Planned Parenthood provider who, you know, practices both in North Carolina and Virginia. And she really pointed out the contrast in how, you know, our rules of medication abortion vary compared to just our neighboring state of Virginia. So there they have access to telehealth where they can access an abortion, you know, through telehealth. So it's quite a contrast of just when she stands in North Carolina, what she can do for patients versus those she serves in Virginia.
But even with all that you said that, I guess, North Carolinians, the numbers are higher than the national average in use of this particular abortion pill, correct?
Yeah, despite, you know, these additional requirements we have, medication abortion still accounts for about 70% of total abortions in the state of North Carolina. From what, you know, my conversations with providers, really, they're just having to overcome, you know, quite a few challenges. And people really, as hard as it is, to the best of their abilities, people make every effort to, you know, go to these two appointments to overcome this. You know, for others, they've told me that they do see patients go to, like, Virginia because it may be easier to just get that, you know, one appointment. So it's a difficult landscape, but people are still definitely accessing medication abortion when they can.
Mm. Are there other parts of the potential ruling by the Supreme Court that could impact North Carolinians, maybe that we don't know about?
Yes. So while, you know, North Carolina may not feel the effects of this ruling, if it were to go in favor of rolling back restrictions on the FDA, since we haven't felt those loosening of access to begin with, it would still really affect North Carolinians. A lot of providers I spoke to, you know, made this point of our abortion landscape across the whole nation is very interconnected. So any change in one state has an effect on another. So for example, you know, right now people in Virginia can access abortion via telehealth, and a lot of people are doing that. But if this ruling were to take that ability away, you know, all those people that were, you know, just accessing it via telehealth would now have to go into clinics, and that would take away the capacity to serve other people. And maybe North Carolinians who are trying to go to Virginia for care, you know, maybe have a harder time, you know, getting into the clinic, getting an appointment. So it's just all these ripple effects across the country that could just strain capacity across the nation, which would be felt in North Carolina, because North Carolina clinics are already, you know, really strained to meet the capacity as it is.
You know, can you sort of just outline the differences between, I guess, the medication abortion and then the procedural abortion? Because it's kind of surprising to me when I heard the numbers, you know, that 70% of people in North Carolina actually have the medication abortion.
Mm-hmm. So medication abortion is kind of the most common method to end a pregnancy in North Carolina, as we said, and across the nation. So this process involves taking two pills to terminate a pregnancy, one being mifepristone, which we've discussed throughout this conversation, and the other being misoprostol. So these pills, you know, can be safely taken up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. And basically, you know, these abortion pills will, you know, stop a pregnancy from progressing. And then the other pill will, you know, cause the uterus to cramp and bleed, you know, similar to an early miscarriage, and end the pregnancy that way. And then obviously with a surgical abortion or procedural abortion, you know, you're in a clinic, the physician will do the procedure, you know, that way to end the pregnancy. So it was actually interesting. I talked to one provider and she's like, why? Or I asked her, why do people choose medication abortion? And, you know, it feels more natural maybe. But then she also brought up now in this post-ops era of what she's seeing is like some people are going back to preferring procedural abortion because they want to leave that day and know for sure like the pregnancy is ended and like be 100% confident. They don't want to stress about it. So it was kind of interesting to see the different perspectives of what's going on.
I was talking with some friends about my upcoming conversation with you, and maybe I didn't explain it well. And they said, oh, isn't that just the morning after pill? And I said, no, mifepristone is not the morning after pill. You know, there's a maybe explain that difference to those listening.
Yeah, there's quite a big difference of, you know, the morning after pill is to, you know, after sex to just prevent a pregnancy from even beginning. You know, mifepristone, a pregnancy is already there, but, you know, mifepristone works by blocking progesterone, which is a hormone essential to the development of pregnancy. So thereby, you know, by cutting off that hormone, it prevents the pregnancy from progressing further.
Mm. So when you think of like the circumstances under which a patient might be looking for the abortion medication, you know, how do they actually access that? I mean, I guess a doctor or someone has to prescribe that.
Yeah. In the state of North Carolina, you need to go to a clinic and see a physician and, you know, get the pills dispensed that way. There are several states that have shield laws, meaning that those providers, those physicians can prescribe pills in other states, even where abortion is restricted. So some people can access it that way. And there's other sites, you know, like Aid Access that are online providers who can distribute abortion pills to people in all 50 states.
Well, back to this big case that we've been watching, you know, North Carolinians on both sides of the debate, you met with them actually in Washington, D.C., who were outside of the Supreme Court during those hearings. So if the Supreme Court, like, rules in favor of this challenge, again, what would happen? Or what could happen?
So if there's a ruling in favor of the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, that would, you know, effectively roll back rules on how mifepristone can be dispensed to, like, the pre-2016 times. So again, it would eliminate some of these new options that people are now relying upon to access abortion. So that being, you know, telehealth, getting pills through the mail, all of that would kind of be off the table, and it would be much more difficult to access mifepristone.
Mm. Do you have any idea where this case stands now before the Supreme Court?
They will be making their ruling. It's expected in about June, which is kind of the end of their session. So we'll have about a couple months of waiting to see what is done. But like I said, from the questioning that the justices had, it seems like they were reluctant to, roll back the use of mifepristone. It seems like they were likely to preserve access as it is. So we'll see what happens.
Well, Rachel Crumpler is a reporter for North Carolina Health News covering reproductive health. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Leonita Inge. You're listening to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. Welcome back to Due South.
As I'm being followed by a moon shadow.
The day of the 2024 solar eclipse that we've been hearing so much about has finally arrived, and we've got an expert here to talk about where the total eclipse path will be. You know, the recent and not so recent history of the total solar eclipses in the U.S. we'll talk about, and also what to expect today when viewing from the Triangle area. Dr. Amy Sell is science education specialist at Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center, located on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. She joins me to talk all things eclipse. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I always like to talk safety first. So before listeners, you know, sort of think they can point their eyes to the sky to observe this phenomenon, you know, please tell us what we need to do to protect our eyes, you know, when it comes to a solar eclipse. And I know you're used to talking to young ones, so I think this is the time to talk to us like we're third graders.
Okay, sounds good. So if you want to look at the sun, whether it's eclipsed or not, you should be using something like eclipse glasses, which are made for looking at the sun. You want to make sure that you have gotten them from a safe supplier. The American Astronomical Society has been warning of counterfeits and fakes.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and before you use eclipse glasses, always check, make sure that they're not damaged. They don't have pinpricks. They're not, you know, tearing away from the frame. They don't have rips in them or anything like that. If you don't have eclipse glasses, though, you can still indirectly see the eclipse by using a method called pinhole projection. And in pinhole projection, you are not looking through a hole at the sun. What you're doing is you have your back to the sun and you let the sunlight fall through a small hole. you may have heard of like cereal box pinhole projectors and stuff like that. You don't have to even make it that complicated. You can use anything with holes, such as a kitchen colander or maybe a straw hat or even your own fingers. If you can imagine kind of spreading your fingers across and overlapping them to create a waffle pattern. So you've got your back to the sun, you're letting the sunlight fall through the holes that your fingers are creating. And you, if you, especially if you like lay down a white sheet of paper, you might be able to project some images of a crescent sun onto it.
I think I see it now. Excellent.
And you can also let our wonderful North Carolina trees do the work for you.
We have a lot of trees here, don't we?
When you're walking along the sidewalk, look down at the ground. The gaps between tree leaves can act like pinhole projectors that put images of the sun onto the ground. And during an eclipse, that can be pretty exciting.
Oh, this sounds exciting already. I hate that I won't be in the path, probably, of a solar eclipse this year, but I remember 2017.
Well, I think you are going to be in a path, not for totality, because unfortunately, unlike 2017, where the path of totality did run through a little part of North Carolina, this one in 2024, the path of totality, if you can kind of imagine, roughly 115-mile-wide path running roughly southwest to northeast through Mexico, kind of imagine a line going from Texas through Ohio to Maine and then kind of out eastern Canada. That's a path of totality. And in North Carolina, though, we get a pretty decent partial solar eclipse.
Well, I look forward to that. But before we keep talking about this, some basics. Please explain, what is a solar eclipse?
So a solar eclipse, the lineup is, if you can imagine this, sun, moon, and then Earth. So the moon is always orbiting the Earth. It takes about a month to orbit the Earth. And usually when it's between the sun and Earth, that's called new moon phase. Usually it's passing above or below the sun because the moon's orbit around Earth is tilted with respect to Earth's orbit around the sun. So usually the moon will look like it's missing the sun. But there's a couple of times a year where we have the potential for the moon to pass in front of the sun. And then the moon's shadow falls on Earth. And if you're in the moon's shadow, you get a solar eclipse.
So because of what you do with the Moorhead Planetarium, I'm sure you get to tell many people, young and old, about what an eclipse is, and especially now. I mean, how busy have you been at the planetarium?
We've had lots of excitement about this upcoming solar eclipse. In our planetarium shows, we're able to show simulations, both of how it will look like from North Carolina, the partial solar eclipse, but we also have a simulation where we show what it looks like from the path of totality. Like, for example, if it is clear in Texas, we have a view from Waco, Texas, what you would see. But in North Carolina, the action unfolds Monday afternoon, the 8th, from roughly 2 p.m. to roughly 4:30 p.m. So it's a 2.5-hour event. Now, your mileage may vary in terms of the exact start time and the exact end time. It depends on where you are in the state. But for Chapel Hill, for example, the moon will first appear to touch the edge of the sun at 1:58 p.m. It'll be over by 4:28 p.m. And eclipse maximum is 3:15 p.m., when from Chapel Hill, and it's, you know, very close, very similar for the triangle, about 80% of the sun's area will look like it's being covered up by the moon.
Wow. You know, I live in the triangle, but I thought I would have to jet to some other part of the state. But in the triangle area, will we see most of, like you say, 80% here? Are there other spots in the state that may have a better view?
I did some spot checking various towns in North Carolina, and it does go up to about, it kind of depends on how you measure it. There are different, we probably don't need to get into the weeds on that, but roughly about 85% of the sun will be covered for some other locations that are closer to the path of totality, and a little bit less as you get farther away from the path of totality.
You know, we've heard you mention that term a few times now, so I need you to please tell me, what is the path of totality, and what does that mean, and where will it be again?
Sure. So, sadly, the path of totality does not run. We can talk about how long you have to wait to get a total solar eclipse again in North Carolina. But if you're in the path of totality, what it means is that for you, And this is hoping skies are clear for everywhere along the path. That means for you, the moon completely blocks the sun. You are in the moon's umbral shadow. That's the dark inner part of the moon. Day becomes night, or probably more accurate to say deep twilight. And it's pretty abrupt. My experience of the total solar eclipse in 2017, it was like somebody had dropped a black curtain on the land. It was incredible.
It's going to be that dark in some in the path.
It's wow. Wild, and you get this kind of 360 degree sunset glow. It's in all directions, not just in the west. And bright stars and planets will pop into view as well. This is, again, if you're in the path of totality, the temperature noticeably drops. Animals might act differently, as if night has come. Humans definitely act differently. And if you're on the center line of that path of totality, you can get over 4 minutes of that experience.
That was going to be my next question. How long will we have that darkness?
Yeah, so that's only for people in that path. And so there are many maps available online. I'm not going to be able to reel off from memory the more than a dozen states it cuts across, but unfortunately, none of them are North Carolina, not this time. And I should mention that for anybody that is planning on traveling to the path of totality, make sure you get all the way in the path. Don't settle for a 99% eclipse if you have the opportunity of getting a 100% total solar eclipse. It is quite literally the difference between night and day. Even 1% of the sun shining is a lot of sunlight.
A lot of light.
So for us in North Carolina, with at eclipse maximum around 3:15 p.m., 80% or so of the sun covered, you might not notice much of a difference in the sky. I'll be curious, actually, to hear what people report. I've seen a partial eclipse that was even more than that. I couldn't tell, but other people did tell me that they thought that the light looked weird and the sky kind of looked weird.
Well, Dr. Amy Sell is Science Education Specialist at Morehead Planetarium and Science Center, and we're talking about the eclipse. So it's got to be real exciting to be a part of it this year. So I wonder, when you talk to other science educators, what are you all talking about? How have you been preparing, you know, your communities?
Yeah, so there are a number of organizations planning on hosting eclipse viewing events, and I would urge people that if that's of any interest to you, it can be really fun to experience an eclipse with your community and with your friends and family and make some memories together. So, for example, at Morehead Planetarium and Science Center, we're hosting an eclipse viewing event on Monday afternoon from 12:30 p.m. to 4:45 p.m. Now, remember, the partial eclipse itself is running from about 2 to 4:30. But we're going to start early and do some hands-on activities outside and have some safe solar viewing. And then that's all free. And then there'll be a ticket price to go inside, but we'll be showing a live stream of the eclipse, more activities, and also doing simulations with the planetarium sky, doing some more education inside the planetarium. There are other events, though, too, across the state. So Morehead Planetarium produces the North Carolina Science Festival each year. The Science Festival happens during the entire month of April, hundreds of science events across the state. And as part of the Science Festival, there's always a statewide star party. And many of those statewide star party events are doing eclipse viewing. So if you don't live in Chapel Hill, check the North Carolina Science Festival website. There might be an eclipse viewing event that's nearer to where you live.
Well, definitely. I hope so. Hope there are many. So in going back in time a bit, let's talk about the last time, you know, there was a U.S. Solar eclipse, or there was a solar eclipse that we actually got to participate in. I mentioned 2017. That's the last one that I remember.
That's the last total solar eclipse that I can think of, definitely in the 48 states. That was it was total in a southwestern corner of North Carolina, and then a lot of South Carolina. So I know a lot of North Carolinians actually drove to South Carolina for that. And then there was another total solar eclipse in North Carolina that folks who are old enough may remember, March of 1970. That was more of eastern North Carolina, but I've had people bring that one up to me. And if you want to see a total solar eclipse from the Triangle area, mark your calendar 54 years from now. May 11th.
We'll be here,
Amy, right?
We'll be here.
Yes. May 11th, 2078.
Wow.
It's a Wednesday. And I'm sure we'll have an amazing eclipse viewing event at the Moorhead Sundial that day.
I look forward to it. Hopefully we have a legacy that'll be there. So again, how different, okay, when I think the path of totality, you know, like really, is that path larger or smaller than in 2017?
Yeah, so there's some differences between that one and 2017. So it's a different path. That one, the 2017 one, cut across the 48 states. You know, starting in Oregon and going out through South Carolina. And it wasn't as wide. The moon varies its distance between us and Earth a little bit, and the moon's a little bit closer to us than it was in that 2017 one. The path is wider this time. The 2017 path was roughly 70 miles wide. This one is roughly 115 miles wide. Also, a lot more people live in the path of this 2024, the path of totality, and a lot of people can drive to it as well. So I'm hoping a lot more people will see this one, whether it's total or partial. Most of North and Central America and even a bit of South America is getting at least a partial solar eclipse Monday afternoon.
I wonder how long have we actually been recording eclipses? You know, how far back?
Oh,
and if people were really afraid of them, like we're rallying around, we're having eclipse parties, but it wasn't always like this.
Yeah, people have observed eclipses, of course, as long as there have been people.
Right.
They're awe-inspiring events, and yes, have inspired terror, I'm sure, in many people throughout the ages. If you don't know it's coming. And then you see like the moon's shadow coming at you and then suddenly enveloping you. That would be quite an experience. And there's a number of wonderful cultural stories about eclipses. They often involve animals running into the sky and taking a bite out of the sun.
That's a beautiful story. Now, I guess that brings me to why I was thinking, why are we so fascinated? You know, are there stories like that that makes us fascinated about eclipses? People are kind of going crazy here.
Yeah. I mean, there's intellectual reasons to
right.
be fascinated. It's a science event. The 1919 solar eclipse actually provided a test of Einstein's theory of general relativity. A total solar eclipse is the only time you can see the sun's corona, the outer atmosphere, so a great opportunity to study that. But there are emotional reasons and psychological reasons to be excited about eclipses. I mean, it's a spectacle of nature. It can be a reminder that we live on a planet. We live in a solar system with massive moving objects. It can help you get a little perspective.
Yeah, we can't control everything, can we?
Right. I mean, we know it's going to happen, and it will. It will happen, just like clockwork.
And just a final reminder, safety. For
yes.
those who may be in the path.
Yes, which is presumably everybody listening to this, because we're all having at least a partial solar eclipse in most of North America on the 8th. And remember that you should not look directly at the sun, whether it's eclipsed or not. The only exception, and this does not apply to anyone in North Carolina, the only exception is in a total solar eclipse during totality, it's okay to look. But that is not the case for any of us in North Carolina this time. Also, binoculars and telescopes, boy, you want to be 100% sure you know what you're doing. They have to have proper ISO-certified solar filters that are properly attached. Your eclipse glasses will not help you in that situation. Also, don't look through cameras at the sun. The camera is not going to protect you either. So just be careful with that. And of course, if you've got young children, you want to be sure to supervise them.
Well, thank you very much. I think I got all that checked off on my list. Dr. Amy Sale, Science Education Specialist, Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you for being with me today.
Thanks so much. Happy eclipse viewing.
Thank you. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Codell Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. Jeff Tiberi is my co-host. I'm Leonita Inge. This is Due South. A total eclipse of the heart.